You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Jones, Bowden,
he's got it. England have won the World Cup by the barest of margins.
Stokes flashes it away through the covers for four, and England have won the match.
Hello, welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket, and we're knee deep in both a heatwave, most of the country anyway, and also the 100. The 100, which is much maligned, actually. It's a bit of a polarising tournament. People seem to love it or hate it. I don't know what you feel listening to this, but we're going to try and explore it in a bit of detail, both with Simon Mann, who's sort of ambivalent about it, I think, and also with an expert, and an expert in the field of data. And actually, we've had this guy on our show before, and it was one of the most popular and successful shows we've done, actually. So welcome to Dan Weston for the second time, who is an absolute data specialist in cricket world, runs his own SAA Advantage analytics company, does blogging on Substack, and also works for a couple of franchises, the Birmingham Phoenix in the 100, and also the Punjab Kings in the IPL. And is hoping to get more contracts in the future too. Actually, Dan, before we sort of get into the detail of this and how much dependency there is on data, just tell us what's happened to you since, I suppose, the last time you were on, when you were hoping to become an analyst for a team.
Yeah, so thanks for having me on, Simon. I think it's been about 4 years, must be about 4 years since we last chatted on this. A lot has happened. I mean, I think when I first started, I started off as with this mission to be a bit of a data-driven disruptor, if you like, someone who is probably fairly willing to put their head above the parapet and maybe try and challenge a lot of conventional wisdom. And to some extent, I'm still a bit like that, but I kind of probably mellowed a little bit in that respect. And now I feel like I've hit quite a happy medium of working. When I'm working with the teams, it's providing data, a lot of insights, but also sort of cooperating with the coaches and understanding their points of view, and actually kind of using the two methodologies a lot of the time, perhaps the data-driven insights and a coach's experience or the eye test. There's almost like they're not enemies. They're actually things that can go really well with each other, complement each other, as this like a double tick, if you like, in a lot of ways. So working with teams has given me a lot more experience with that. And I think when you're, regardless of which team you're working for, you're always going to be rubbing shoulders and spending time with great coaches, ex-players, etc. And you can't fail to learn from people like that.
How much have you been accepted by the coaches and the players, Dan?
That's a great question. I think to some degree it's a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy, because the teams that I work with have obviously got coaches who are open to this type of thing, whereas obviously the teams who I haven't worked with probably may not be so open to it. But the coaches that I've worked with on the whole have been really, really good. Players-wise, I think The answer is it depends. Some of the perhaps the more experienced players may be a bit more reticent about this type of thing, but I've also had some great conversations with older players as well. Younger players do tend to like it. I've had a lot of players come to me and say, look, what am I doing well? What am I doing badly? And it's a really honest conversation that we've had. And I think that if you can word it correctly as well as particular, you can really improve a player and help them evolve and take their game to the next level as well. So I really welcome it. I love it when a young player in particular comes to me and says, you know, what can we work on?
And what they're talking about, or what they're asking about, is purely data, are they? They're not asking you, do I need to grip my bottom hand a bit tighter or open the face a bit more, you know, to the left arm spinner. They're actually looking at the stats. Can you give us an example? It doesn't have to name the name, the player, but
I was speaking to someone the other day about how good his T20 bowling is when he hits a good length, and he didn't actually know that. So it was really pleasing to be able to give him that really positive feedback and sort of a constructive advice to maybe change his lengths a little bit and he could be very, very successful doing that. There's a lot of examples of that. Fielding positions as well. So, for example, I've got a benchmark figure for how often the average right-hander will hit through a 45-degree segment of the ground. So if a player is leaking runs through a certain area on a regular basis or much more than those benchmarks, then you can look to try and resolve those issues as well. That type of thing.
That's because he needs a better field at backward point, maybe. No, I mean, that's a bit facetious. So, you know, give us a little bit of a lowdown on, let's say, you know, you're about to help the Birmingham Phoenix play against the Southern Brave, which, of course, is the repeat of last year's final in the 100. That was a very exciting game, actually, which, of course, the Southern Brave won in the end. So your opposition tomorrow are pretty fearsome. What is the process? The game starts at, what, 6:30? So what's your day holding store leading up to the match itself?
Well, generally speaking, on the day of a game, you won't necessarily have a lot to do because hopefully we've done all the prep in advance. So, but there'll be a lot of work that goes into a game, regardless of the teams that I'm working for, whether it's Birmingham or other teams. There'll be a lot of prep. I'll do a pack before a match, but that's not unusual. That's a very, very commonplace thing in this industry. You'll be doing opposition scouting, understanding their strengths and weaknesses, and ultimately looking to exploit their weaknesses and negate their strengths in whatever way you can.
You talk about a pack there. So do you mean a pack of data, different sheets? With, I mean, I've seen the ones that the analysts use in, say, the IPL, and it's a picture of a batsman, say, that's in the opposition, and it might be a beehive from Hawkeye sort of superimposed on that batsman at the crease with their strike rate at certain points when the ball passes the bat, and therefore hot zones to focus on and other zones to avoid. So is it things like that with little tips for where to bowl at a particular player?
Yeah, absolutely. And also some of the best packs that you see around with some teams as well is they'll do interactive video as well, so the players can then download the packs onto their phones and watch video of the, if they're a bowler, they can look at the batter's dismissals or dots or boundaries or whatever they want to, whatever rabbit hole they want to go down, basically they can go and do that. So I think from my perspective, it's all about enabling the coaching staff and the players to try and make the best decisions in the game, but which obviously is down to them. So it's always advice. It's never really you must do this or you must do that. It's this is what the data is telling us is a good plan, and it's up to you how you want to execute that.
The idea of a pack sounds quite intimidating. It sounds like quite a lot of data, you know, pack.
Or a bunch of wolves.
How much do the players, or how much can they take on board, or how much do you expect them to take on board? I mean, are you talking two or three key points, or are you expecting them to take on a bit more than that? You know, there might be 5 or 6 points, and actually it strikes me that if you do get to that level, that you know there's the danger of perhaps overloading a player.
So I think most of the time you'll be maybe 4 to 6 bullet points on a batter, for example. That's pretty normal throughout the industry. And then there's nothing which is compelling the player to actually watch the videos or read the packs themselves. It's not like football, I think, where, you know, a head coach can give the squad a document to read to for set piece practice or whatever, and they will know if the player's opened it and read it. It's not like that. It really is down to the player to prepare themselves best. And if they feel that they can prepare themselves best by not looking at this, then that's fine, as long as they play well on the pitch, and because obviously every player's accountable for their performance ultimately.
Do you sense, though, from the way they play and the way they've reacted to a particular opponent, that they have read it or they haven't read it?
Sometimes. it can happen. Sometimes you might think, oh, he's clearly ignored that or something like that. But ultimately, like I said, it's down to the player. And if they can come up with a reason as to why that they've done something, and that's down to them.
So that's fascinating, because as the sort of analyst, where do you sit then between player and coach? Because you could say to the coach, well, you know, in debrief meetings, well, you know, I did tell him, but he clearly didn't take on board. And do you then sort of get the coach involved, and the coach say, well, go to the player and say, you know, Dan gave you this information, you didn't use it, could you explain why you didn't use it?
I'm not really keen on going down that road, to be honest, Simon. I think that if it was a long-term problem, then something might happen. But on a one-off or semi-regular basis, it wouldn't be a major problem. So I'm quite careful not to force what I do on any player. So any player's got to be very willing to listen and to take things on board. So I haven't really seen an instance of that, really.
And the coaches, are they sort of hungry for this? I mean, I know you said that if the fact you're employed by a particular team suggests that they are open minded, etc. And are they say, right, Dan, what have you got for me today? You know, what can we do today? Give me something.
Yeah, no, that happens a lot. So you know, you might get a few WhatsApps through a day and say, look, what about this? What do you think about this idea? Can you give me some stats or evidence as to why this might be a good idea or a bad idea? And that might be a strategy thing. It might be a recruitment thing, or whatever it might be. It depends on what we need to sort out at that particular time of the season or ahead of a match. But no, that happens a lot, and I like that. I prefer the coaches that constantly engage you. And luckily, I'm fortunate enough to work with quite a few at the moment. So that's really good.
How many teams are doing this? Can you give us an idea? Are we talking, you know, every 100 team? Are we talking about every IPL team? Are we talking about every T20 team, every county championship team, every international team? Or do you sense that some are more driven by data than others?
I think it's quite nuanced. So, for example, in county cricket, all 18 counties will have an analyst. But whether they're an analyst who actually really has any input, apart from coding and processing video, is certainly debatable. As far as I'm aware, I'm the only analyst in the country who really specialises in recruitment. So that's definitely a rarity. I did obviously the IPL auction in February, and I didn't see much evidence of many other recruitment analysts there. There was some quick risk presence there. Apart from that, I didn't really see a great deal. So I would say that some teams view, well, every team will have an analyst, but I think a lot of them will view it as a tick box exercise a lot of the time. And they won't really come up with any meaningful strategy changes to the head coach or really influence the results in any way, shape or form, or recruitment or future planning or whatever it might be. It's more coding and video, and I think this is where the industry has to evolve a little bit, because I understand that this is almost like a template that comes through for analysts, is that they have to do this coding and the video and stuff. And I think that from speaking to a lot of other analysts, perhaps as they come through the system, if you like, they're not encouraged to have independent thought, whereas I've come from a more of an unconventional background, and I've relied on independent thought, and that's, I guess, my USP to some degree.
Is it also a question where you're different in that you tend to look quite far back at players? You're also sort of their youth performances and things, and so that you get a good picture of their transitions, their evolutions, and you can use the past to predict the future kind of thing.
Yeah, and I've always said, Simon, that it's not perfect. It's not an exact science, but the past is a very good indicator of future performance, particularly if you understand age curve analysis and things like that. So using players' performance, say when they're 19 or 20, to try and understand what level they might be at when they're 25, for example, is a really useful tool. So, for example, if a player's outperforming the current England players at a young age when the England players were at that age, if that makes sense, then that's a real positive, and you're almost on a kind of shot to nothing really with those type of players, because the odds are that they're going to develop into a really nice player and at worst be, you know, a good county player or something, for example.
So what you mean is that you might have seen, say, Joe Root playing for England under-19s, averaging 43, and you knew that Alistair Cook, when he played for England under-19s, averaged only 38 or something, and you see what Alistair Cook achieved, so you can sort of almost say, well, Joe Root could achieve even more, kind of thing. That's a sort of hypothetical example.
Yeah, so, for example, for T20 or the 100, you might say, okay, well, Jason Roy, Alex Hales, Owen Morgan, Josh Butler, Johnny Bairstow, Joe Root, their numbers when they were 21 were X, Y, Z, etc. And then if you could find someone who's markedly better than that at the same age, then that makes sense, that logical sense, that with average career progression, they're going to be a very good player.
Apart from me, because I think when my first couple of years, you know, when I was only 20, I think I averaged something like 16 per wicket in the county championship. And as opposed to most bowlers who get better with age, I got worse. Anyway, there we are. It's another story.
Just while we're on the subject of young players, actually, and it's become a sort of just a minor obsession of mine. What do you make of Tristan Stubbs? What have you got any statage on him? Well, yeah, go on.
So I was tipped off about him a while back by a South African analyst. So having as I've evolved since we last spoke, I've built up a good contact list around the world, and I do tend to get tip offs about high potential talent, I should say, from a young age. So I knew about Tristan last year, and he's someone who I can see from lower level stats in South Africa was very, very six hitting orientated, which is obviously kind of how he's developed in time, and obviously very high intent, high power. So it was obvious seeing those stats from a lower level that there was a skill set there for sure.
So yeah, so I don't know, what does that mean for the future? Is it too difficult to say from here? Is it?
Yeah. So someone asked me this question actually about him a couple of weeks ago, and for me, what I want to see now is probably a 250 ball sample of him against what I call franchise level bowlers or international level bowlers. And then I'll be able to have a stronger view about how good he could be.
I can see that. I mean, I was fascinated by his innings at Bristol. It was flat, the boundaries were short, the bowling wasn't, you know, it was okay, but what's he going to be like when he comes up against top class spinners in the IPL, for example, or top class overseas fast bowlers in the IPL, whatever. You know, we'll go from there. But it's one of those careers that you think, yeah, it's interesting. I see how this guy is going to develop. Let's just talk about the IPL auction, because you were involved in recruitment. Could you talk a little bit more about that? What you're able to say about what you tried to do for the Punjab Kings?
So it was a really thorough process, actually. So it must have been about 4 weeks working remotely in England, regular Zoom calls with the management at Punjab. And then I went over for the auction for a couple of weeks, had to do a spell in isolation prior to the tournament because there was a bubble. And again, we were working very, very hard, planning, doing mock auctions and things like that. And just generally being, you know, making sure that we didn't leave anything to chance. And it was quite strange, actually, because I walked into the auction room, and it obviously something I watched on TV a number of times in the past, and I didn't feel nervous because I felt that I genuinely couldn't have prepared any better for the actual event. So I was pretty confident we'd assembled a good team as long as we kind of kept to the script, which you can never really guarantee in the IPL auction for any team, I don't think. And there are a lot of ifs, buts and maybes. So, you know, sometimes you might have a limit for a particular player and that gets exceeded. And then the implications of that is that you've got to then spend more on a different player but who has a similar skill set or something like that. So there's you can never really go in with fixed plans. You've got to have a rough idea about what you want to do, and then it sort of stems off on a decision tree branch from there, kind of thing.
How close did you get to what you wanted? Or
yeah, very actually. I think we executed our plans pretty well. If you look at the number of bids that we put in for players, it was lower than most other teams, if not all of the other teams. So it showed that we were very, very clear with our thinking and our planning in terms of if we wanted a player, we identified a particular player, we would do a lot to try and get that player. I know that there was some other teams who maybe put like three times as many bids in for different players as we did. So they were maybe a bit more sort of haphazard, whereas I felt that we had a lot of clear plans. And I think on the whole, we executed them really well. There's probably, I don't think you can ever leave an auction room and say, without saying, I wish I'd done this or I wish I'd done that and maybe gone one more bid for this player or something like that. But I think on the whole, we walked away from that really satisfied.
So the auction went well. You felt the auction went well. How did the team performing on the pitch compare to how the auction went in terms of your expectation of how it was going to go?
It's a great question because obviously after the auction, I flew back to England and I didn't go back out to India for the actual tournament. So if you read my Twitter timeline, there's probably a lot of people actually think that I'm somehow was actually there, but no one could see me on TV or something like that. And I didn't really have a lot of input into the tournament subsequently. Now, I think we were unfortunate in terms of a few fine margins going against us. So we lost a lot of tosses to start with, and in the subcontinent, that's very, very important with the G factor. And also, I think there was one game where Tawatia hit two sixes off the last two balls when they had 12 to win off two balls. You know, that's statistically a very unlikely occurrence. So, and that game ultimately cost us the qualification. If we won one more game, we would have been in the top four. One thing that I, regardless of any results, is that I was so pleased because I got a lot of really nice positive messages from Punjab fans saying that they felt that the team had a really nice, clear identity this year, something that they could resonate with. So as people who know me might realise, I'm quite strong on building an attacking, boundary-hitting team. Ultimately, we're talking about stats. Around 87% of T20 matches are won by the team with the higher boundary percentage in the match. So it makes sense to try and recruit players who can facilitate that. Obviously, there's a two-way street because you've got to find good boundary preventers with the ball as well. But that's a clear identity that I try and create. And I think it's a good identity. I think the fans enjoy it. It's a very watchable brand. And, you know, being really honest with you, there are some teams playing T20 around the world, and if I didn't have a free subscription to satellite TV, I wouldn't pay to watch them. Whereas I think that everyone enjoyed watching Punjab Kings and ultimately Birmingham Phoenix last summer as well because of the style of play that we had. It was a very clear identity, a clear brand of cricket we were trying to achieve. And I think we've really succeeded in that regardless of any results.
Well, actually, I back that up because I remember being at the final and we were in the mound stand. And Mark Nicholas and Mark was on our show last week, actually. We were saying that there was a spell of cricket in that final when George Gartman and Timal Mills were bowling at Liam Livingston and Moeen Ali. And it was electric. It was just brilliant. I mean, the ball was flying through at 100 miles an hour. The batsmen were swishing wildly at the ball and hitting some and missing others. And the keeper was taking it above his head and the fielders were diving all over the place. The score was whirring up and I mean, it was just staggering to watch. But it's interesting to hear you also say, in a way, that the Punjab Kings got scuppered a couple of times by, you know, people hitting sixes off the last couple of balls, which shows that data isn't always king. So what happens when it doesn't go right? You know, when you've made these suggestions and they haven't worked out, how do you deal with that?
I think that there's several approaches to that. So how do I deal with that myself? I think you've got to square a lot of things off in your head before the tournament or the match starts. That if you've done your prep and you're happy with how going into the match when the 11 players walk across the line to go on the field, then it's down to them after that. And I feel like I've got better at that as time has evolved in terms of detaching myself from the result. The other challenge in that is managing upwards, if you like, and maybe trying to keep the people who are above you, the management, not necessarily the head coach, but I'm talking about, you know, owners of a team, for example, keeping them grounded by trusting the process rather than results, because you do kind of get a lot of knee-jerk reactions in that respect. So as long as they understand that it's a process-driven thing. And, you know, if you go through the last decade of T20 teams, you'll find that very few, if any, can win over 60% of matches on a long-term basis. So I call it the 60-40 rule. If you're winning 60% of matches as a T20 team in a level budget league, you are doing exceptionally well. I think it's a bit different for international cricket because there's big budget and player pool disparities. But in a franchise league with level budgets, that's a great benchmark. But ultimately, that still means that you're going to lose 40% of the time.
Why is that, actually? I mean, why isn't it higher? Why isn't one team more dominant?
I think it's because of the variance. So you mentioned that kind of luck element of it a few minutes ago. That variance is definitely prevalent. So, for example, I'll give you another stat. So an uncontrolled aerial shot will have an average of 2.5 balls per dismissal. But there's been games that I've been involved with where the opposition have hit 7 in a row for 4 or 6. And that's effectively a 30 or 40 run difference just off those shots. And so this should be, I don't know, 7 for 2 or 7 for 3 off those 7 balls, and they're 40 for naught, and that's a big difference. And because of that, that is the volatility of T20, the variance of T20. You might find a great matchup and suddenly the opposition take it down, or you get the guy out that you're planning to get out, but then the guy coming in is a bad matchup after that, and then he takes you down, or something like that. There's a lot of intangibles, a lot of variables in it as well. But the way I see it is that if you can give a team a few one percenters or a few more than one percenters, then that's really giving them an advantage.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
What you do, Dan, does it work better the shorter the game? So 100, T10, T20, rather than, say, 5-day cricket or 4-day cricket?
I don't think so. I get why people say that. I've had this conversation with quite a few people. I think that it naturally gravitates to the shortest formats because every ball is a major event, and perhaps, obviously, T20, it's just under 1% of your resources for a match as a batting or a bowling team. So that's important. You've got to win those, you know, small battles all the time. But I do think that it's extremely applicable to, for example, Test cricket as well. Yes, there's 90 overs a day and it's 5 days long, but you have to have the right strategies, you know. I've seen England, for example, they've picked Dominic Best in the last couple of years against a team full of right-handers. And you don't need to have detailed analytics to know that he's better against left-handers. So that's one area of selection that could be massively improved. And you know, there's been times that England have played against left-handers or four left-handers in the top six or something, and he hasn't played. So there's a lot of stuff that you can do in longer formats as well. And the matchups in Test cricket, I think, is huge too. You do find that spinners do have a lot of variation and bias towards bowling to specific batters. And more often than not, I find that teams are rather unaware of that or unwilling to understand that.
Let's talk about England's T20 team and the T20 World Cup. I noticed a tweet that you put out after their hammering at Southampton. And there's an aspect of that, actually, I'd like to talk about in just a moment. But you said it's an ageing team. The decline was evident before Owen Morgan quit. They've got injuries. And there were curious selections and omissions. What do you think of England's T20 team at the moment? What are they doing wrong then? I mean, there's certain things they can't control. I mean, injuries they can't control, but they can control, well, your curious selections and omissions. They can control that.
I think that it's all of the above, really, Simon. So you look at the injury problems to start with. I think I'm pretty certain that I'm correct in saying that it hasn't happened since the 2019 World Cup that Wood, Wokes and Archer have been in the same team. So I think that it's very difficult to plan for that to be the case when there's historical evidence to say that there's a very low chance they're all going to be on the park at the same time.
Recording in progress.
So that's something that they should have been looking at other players. So one of my bugbears over the, I think they played 12 white ball matches in 25 days, was that they pretty much picked the same team the vast majority of the time. They didn't use those matches to look at, say, a Will Jacks to have a look at, see if he might be better than Jason Roy, for example. And we talk about the age dynamic of the squad. Out of the 13 who played in the World Cup, only Liam Livingstone and Timar Mills were under 30 at the time. At the time I wrote about that tweet, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, and Mills is 30 this month. So when you're constructing a roster for a team, you really need to bear in mind that age dynamic and understand that there will be a time that group ages together and will need some significant surgery moving forward. So I equate it to a bit like the England golden generation of in football, you know, Gerrard and Lampard and Rooney and Rio Ferdinand, John Terry, for example, and they all got old at the same time. And then they've had to have a bit of a period of pain before the next group becomes good enough to play international football at a high level. And I do think that England should be integrating players into their squad more regularly. I don't have any evidence of this, but it wouldn't surprise me. I feel sometimes that they have a bit of fear that someone who they bring in might actually be better than the person who was there to start with. So that person might be part of the furniture, if you like. So that's tricky sometimes. And I also think that it's difficult, and I don't think this is his fault, but I think it's difficult to have an overseas coach coming in who maybe doesn't have a minute knowledge of the local player pool, for example. So he's probably going, all right, okay, well, this is what we've got at the moment, and we'll go with that and see how it goes. And he's giving everyone a decent opportunity to cement their place in the team. But it would have been nice to see some new faces. Regarding selections, I've been pretty consistent of this over the years, but I think that England have got big problems with their pace bowling in T20 cricket and probably white ball cricket, full stop. I also think that I've pushed Benny Howell to play for a long time, and I think that he would be a great addition to the squad. Bats in the top seven, bowls four overs in pretty much every game, so in a T20 blast, for example, his match involvement is what I call a stat. So that will be the percentage of in a match that a player bats and bowls. He's permanent in the game, and he's a great fielder as well. So I don't understand why he's not been given an opportunity. I think it's a tragedy that he hasn't, to be honest with you. So someone like, for example, Benny or David Willie, who might bat in the top three and bowl four overs. Yeah, Moeen Ali is a great example. Liam Livingstone as well. They will have a higher match involvement because they're batting in key positions and they're bowling a lot as well. Whereas, for example, give you an example of the flip side. With someone like Darren Sammy at the end of his career, who would bat 7 or 8 and not bowl anymore. So that's a very low match involvement. And so if you obviously, if you've got a good player, you want them to impact the match as much as you possibly can. And so someone like Benny does that very well.
Where do you stand on Jason Roy? I mean, he is a player who is, you know, he's in his 30s now, but I mean, he's only 32. He's not that old. You think actually, you know, some players are, you know, can be at their, well, you tell me, some players can be at their absolute peak at 32, but they've got that experience, they're used to the surroundings, and they've got that quality as well, and that confidence from the, you know, from having done it as well, you know, and they've got a lot of ability. Is it time to replace him, or as Kevin Peterson said, you know, leave him alone. You know, he's a quality player who will come good again.
I think 32 would be a young age for a long term decline to start. So, I would like to think that he's got more time to contribute positively. The thing I've noticed with Jason over the last couple of years is that his six hitting intent seems to have fallen. So maybe that's an adaptation to his game that either he's decided to do or has crept in. So does that impact, for example, the way that bowlers bowl against him? I don't know. Does it create less of a fear factor knowing that the bowler, for a bowler, knowing he's not going to get hit for six, whereas Butler or Livingston or an Ali will potentially do that a lot more frequently? I don't know. I'm just coming up with kind of ideas there. But I think it's a difficult sell at the moment to keep him in the team, because there's so many good young openers in this country that there's literally a queue of maybe 5 or 6 names you could reel off, and they would be, in my opinion, considerably above average in international cricket.
One thing I thought about the T20 series, you know, I mean, I don't know what, I actually don't know what the stats said on this, but what I felt, and this is where we talk about stats versus feeling and the psychology, is I was at Bristol and Cardiff, and I watched the Southampton game on the television. But I watched at Bristol, I watched a sort of joyous romp from England's batting side. They batted first. They took control of the game. They took South Africa out of the game because they were able to, well, they played with freedom because they didn't feel the pressure of the chase. Next day at Cardiff, they put the opposition in. And I thought, okay, I don't know what the stats were about chasing, defending at Cardiff, but it seemed to me psychologically the right thing to do was to bat first again. They sort of had South Africa from the night before. Just keep on going, keep doing that, free up, especially after what happened against India. They decided to put South Africa in. South Africa got a decent score, scoreboard pressure, and then a few days later they had the chance to bat first again at Southampton, and they let South Africa bat first, and England crumbled. They lost by 90 runs. Absolute thrashing, massive thrashing in T20 terms. What do you feel about that?
I think that toss decisions can be quite scientific, but I don't think that many teams approach them from a scientific basis. You know, sometimes you might watch a game on TV and the captain's at the toss and he goes, oh, why have you chosen to bat today? And he goes, oh, well, because we've tried to chase for the last two games and we've lost, so we're going to have a go at batting instead. You know, that's just a recency bias argument that really holds no water in terms of logic or common sense. For me, I think it depends where you are in the world as to whether there's a bias, and also what resources you have at your disposal as a squad and what the opposition's strengths and weaknesses are. You have to factor all of those things in as one when you're making that decision. So, for example, in England, if you look at Blast, for example, there's not much of a chasing bias at all. Whereas in the UAE, it's huge because you've got the due factor and it's a lot easier to pace an innings, perhaps on some of the smaller boundaries like Sharjah and Abu Dhabi as well. So there's a massive chasing bias. Certainly in T10, there's a huge chasing bias. Mm. And I think that for the vast majority of the tournament, I think it's something like 30 tosses in a row the team chased who won the toss. So, you know, last season in T10. So there's clear bias there, but not so much in England. And I think that some people view their experiences when they're from the subcontinent, when they're actually making a toss decision in England. If you're a spin-heavy team, sometimes it is better to bat first, particularly if the pitch is used, and then bowl a lot of spin trying to squeeze the team second. Also, the opposition as well. If you if you know that they've got a high intent team but a low balls per dismissal count, for example, you might want to bat first and then try and front load your bowlers to then take early wickets and then get them to panic because their batters are more prone to playing rash shots, for example. So there's a lot of nuance involved in it, and I don't think necessarily a lot of people take that into account when they're making toss decisions.
Mm. So my suggestion, my idea, my feel at Cardiff that England should have batted first. Can that come into it at all? If you say there's no great sort of bias one way or the other about batting first or bowling first, just the sort of, I had the sort of sense that this was a slightly fragile England batting side, and as a result of that, they could take some of the pressure off themselves by batting first and playing with some freedom batting first without the pressure of the target.
So you're looking at what your resources are, and you're helping the decision-making process by considering what your own strengths and weaknesses are as well. Yeah, absolutely. That's something to consider in terms of this makeup of your starting 11. You might want to go one way or the other. There are some grounds in England with some toss biases in T20 cricket. There's a couple where, you know, 9 times out of 10, you probably will want to bat first. But then there's also some others where the vast majority of others don't really have that bias. So a lot of the time it also depends on whether the pitch is fresh or used or something like that as well. So there's a lot of factors to consider. I think some are subjective, but a lot of them I think can be really improved by being influenced by data.
I mean, you've said it there, a lot of data out there. Has it got to the stage where you're tempted now to do like Nathan Lehman and during a Birmingham Phoenix game, wave a couple of numbers at the captain in the field?
I'm not sure we're at that stage yet. I don't mind it as an idea, though. I'm quite open to it as an idea. It's certainly not something that bothers me. And I can understand the logic behind it, because ultimately, I don't know if you captain much, Simon, but it's very difficult to be a captain. You've got to remember a lot of things a lot of the time. Anything that you can give them to remind them of something is definitely a good thing, I think. So as long as it's within the laws, I've got no problem with it.
Do you know, I remember once playing a 40-over game, shows how long ago it was, and it was Duckworth-Lewis. It was a rain-affected game, and the batting pair came out. I think it was Worcestershire we were playing. It was either Worcestershire or Lancashire, and one of the batsmen, it was Steve O'Shaughnessy. He came out to bat with the Duckworth-Lewis different scores printed on the back of his bat, stuck with sellotape. So the different levels, because obviously in those days we didn't have scoreboards with electronic additions that could help you. I mean, I know you've been quite sort of public in saying that perhaps the public at large don't always give the right amount of credibility to all this data and are sort of potentially a bit fed up with it, are they? And yet what you're saying is, in a way, it should be regarded with even more importance.
Definitely. I don't think that cricket has even come close to reaching a plateau in terms of the impact that data can have. Like I said earlier, I think a lot of teams view it as a tick-box exercise. And I don't think that a lot of people, even in the game, understand what's good and what's bad. So I won't name the commentators, but there was one commentator in this week's 100, one of the games this week in the 100, and they said player X is a great death bowler. Well, immediately from that, I got a text from a coach saying, is he really a good death bowler? And I replied back and said, no, he goes over 11s. At the death. So that's a
good for the batting side then.
Yeah, exactly. And then there was another instance where a commentator said, oh, this team have batted poorly in their first innings. They've scored 26 dots. That's terrible. And actually, 26 dots in a 100 ball game is about as good as you'll ever find. So, you know, that would have been in the top percentiles of last season's data for sure. So, and that's someone who you would think would know better than that, but ultimately the stats that they're saying on TV wrongly influence people's opinion on the game. And because they come from obviously high profile ex-players or whatever, people treat them as gospel, and actually they're not.
I've been down a rabbit hole this week, actually, Dan, and I've done expected runs for a number of players in the 100, just out of interest. And I don't know whether the metrics I'm using are quite right, but it's that roughly related to strike rate measured against loss of wickets per ball or something. And interestingly, the man who comes highest in expected runs in my list of about 40 players, most of the prominent players in the 100, the man who comes top is a man in your team. But it's not Mo and Ali, and it's not Liam Livingston. Have you got any idea who it might be?
Would it be Will Smead?
No.
Chris Benjamin.
Chris Benjamin is the answer. Chris Benjamin, who's had a very short career so far and has had a pretty exciting career, and I suppose is in a way perhaps flattered by a small sample size.
Mm. But he's done very, very well against high quality players as well. I mean, he's super exciting talent. So, yeah, I knew that he was average. If you use like the old Basra measurement, if you like, that sometimes they wheel out on TV, batting average and strike rate added, I think his Basra is like 190 or something like that, which is super high. So it doesn't surprise me.
I'm afraid I'm sort of partly responsible for that metric, which I realise it's probably about 10 years ago. And it was the closest I could get to some kind of meaningful stat that wasn't. I mean, when you talk about a player's average in T20, it's almost meaningless because very few of them are sort of more than about 26. So it doesn't sound much, really, does it? And then strike rates can be 220 for someone who only scores, 10 runs per season or something. So it's all a bit skewed. And I was trying to find a usable metric to evaluate players, but things have moved on a bit.
Yes, I think from a recruitment perspective, definitely. The thing with Basra is that...
Basra, so why is it called Basra?
Batting average, strike rate added.
Right, thank you. I thought you were talking about a Middle Eastern city, actually, there. Anyway.
So, for example, like a 30-130 player, 30 average, 130 strike rate, would have a Basra of 160. But that's obviously different to someone who's... 15 and 145, for example, but it's still the same Basra, but a completely different type of player.
Well, I was going to say we could talk about this forever and ever and ever, but it's actually getting quite late, and Dan's got a game tomorrow.
It's not till 6:30. What are you worried about? Plus, well, he's done all his work already. Anyway, he's got a busman's holiday tomorrow.
So that's just finally, Dan. When you're watching games, are you really nervous watching your team play, or you can actually just sit back and relax, and you've done all your work, and it's up to them to perform. Now you've sort of done your side of it. It's up to them. You give it over to them.
I think I've evolved in that, Simon, to be honest with you. So when I first started, I would get very nervous. I used to feel ill before games and stuff like that, but I think as I've done more and more and more, particularly in the dugout environment, I've kind of just rationalised it in my head now that once the players go on the pitch, there's very, very little that you can do to change it. Yeah, you might be able to do a couple of little things or do what Nathan Lehman's done with the numbers, for example. But on the whole, it's then down to them. And if you've prepared well, then that's all you can really do. And so I've kind of got my peace with the fact that once the players go on the pitch, there's no point in getting frustrated. You may as well just stay calm. And it's kind of better for my energies and my mental health sometimes, I suppose.
Simon, what would be your Basra, do you reckon, with the bat? About about 12 or something?
No, I think my Basra would be, low strike rate, definitely a low strike rate.
I don't think you had a strike rate, did you, at all?
you don't want to be getting out, do you? You can't score runs in the pavilion. You got to have it. So low strike rate, I don't know.
15?
45?
45?
Something like that.
You've got to hit a few off the square to get it to 45.
No, but it's average and strike rate. I mean,
So it's a few singles, isn't it?
40 average, 5 strike rate?
Yeah. Not made for T20, or certainly not made for T10 or the 100.
I'm so sorry we didn't have this stuff around, actually, when I was playing, because I'd be fascinated. I'm certainly not, don't remotely want to know what my batting strike rate was, but I'd be interested to know, about bowling kind of patterns and matchups and stuff like that, actually, and who I should have really been bowling at instead of Steve Waugh or Viv Richards, which I always drew the short straw. Anyway, listen, fascinating. Now, where can we read your literary offerings, Dan?
So I'm on Twitter at SA Advantage, and you can read my Substack. There's quite a lot of posts on there, so it might take a while. DanWeston.substack.com.
And there's lots of sort of insight there, so worth following up, eh, Simon?
Definitely, yeah. No, I follow Dan. It's interesting stuff. I like all sorts of different opinions. I think the hardest thing is which I find is struggle to know which opinion to listen to, which opinion to trust. You know, and it's trying to sift through everything actually, and trying to get that sort of that synthesis. And then there's another part of me which sometimes it just goes to the game and just thinks, oh, just enjoy it. Just go there and enjoy the game, enjoy the six hitting, enjoy the wickets, the runs, the catches, the crowd, the atmosphere. And you know, certainly in the test matches this summer, it's been like that, hasn't it? I mean, it's almost defied. I mean, has it defied your expectation, Dan? What's happened this summer in test cricket? Yeah.
I think in two ways. One is the results, obviously. I don't think anyone expected England to win all those matches. But two, the brand and the change in style has been... it's been superb, and I understand from the players that they really, really enjoying the environment right now. So that's great to see. Credit to Brendan McCullum and Ben Stokes for that quick turnaround, definitely. And yeah, it's been. You mentioned about enjoying the game, though. It is tough for me to go to a match or watch a match on TV or go to a match live and just completely lose myself in the game, which perhaps I would have done a few years ago. Now I hear myself going to my wife, he shouldn't be bowling to him or something like that, you know. Yeah. It does happen a lot.
Actually, I was at Lord's last night for the 100, and I saw a couple of players turn the clock back, actually. Karen Pollard launched a couple into the pavilion, and I think he's hit something ridiculous, like 700 sixes in T20 cricket, second to Chris Gayle. And Owen Morgan, actually, a little bit of a cameo from him last night as well. But it's funny, isn't it? When you watch a 100 game or a T20 game and one team wins by about 80 runs, they're actually, you know, talking of stats, I thought the event organisers, whoever they were, hired by Lords, at one point they made the grave error of putting up on the big screen win predictor, London Spirit 100%, Manchester Original 0, and not surprisingly, the ground started to empty and there was still about half an hour's play to go. So I think, you know, Manchester were about sort of 70 for 7 at the time. But that's one time when data doesn't help the cause, really.
I'm not sure I always agree with the win predictor either.
No, well, and I want your prediction for tomorrow then. Birmingham against Southern Brave. I know Birmingham's your team. What's your prediction?
Well, I've got to be in favour of my boys, obviously. Can't see any other way. Got to get revenge on the final from last year as well.
Okay, well, we'll hold you to that. Thanks for your time, anyway, and good luck with everything. It's been fascinating to talk to you. I've got an interesting little assignment myself later in the week, joining up with all my former Durham colleagues in Durham to watch a Royal London Cup game, because it's 30 years since Durham was founded as a first-class county, and we're going to get the whole first team, apart from Dean Jones, who, of course, sadly passed away. We're going to get pretty much the first 11 that played in that first-class debut match in 1992 together. So looking forward to that. I'll report back from that on the next podcast, hopefully get an interview with the big man himself, Beefy Botham, and the other underlings that played in that team. But in the meantime, Dan Weston and Simon Mann, of course, thanks a lot. And thanks for listening to you.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They're also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.